This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
What we're going to deal with this evening is certain aspects of the age-old question: how it is possible that a person of the stature, the wisdom, the prophecy of Yitzchok should have been mistaken about his two sons. How he could have misjudged Esau, bearing in mind how degenerate Esau was. How he could have preferred to give the brochus to Esau over Yitzchok. Bearing in mind that although the first claim on the brochus is to the firstborn, we certainly have many cases where the brocha has not been given to the firstborn, such as the case of Reuven. Reuven was the oldest son of Yaakov, and Reuven loses the rights for a small avera, just for doing something very minor, incorrect. He loses the rights to that special succession, the spiritual succession, to be spiritual successor of his father. So Yitzchok should not have had difficulty in his mind in deciding that even if he didn't see the full degree of Esau's wickedness, surely he perceived enough of the greatness of Yaakov, and the contrast of Yaakov and Esau must have been clear enough for him to be able to understand, to perceive, and to decide that Yaakov is the one who should have received the brachos and not Esau. And more particularly intriguing is the question of why the Ribbono Shel Olam worked it this way. It's clear that there is no way that Esau could have or would have received those brachos. No matter what would have happened, he wouldn't have got them. The brachos had to be given with the acknowledgement of the Ribbono Shel Olam, as we see later on, but Yaakov makes it clear that he can only give the brachos with Hashem's approval. And we have cases where Hashem doesn't approve of a bracha. Let's see if I can find this one for you. When Yaakov wants to bless his grandchildren, and Ephraim and Manasseh are presented to him, he feels himself unable to bless them. And he doesn't have Ruach HaKodesh with him. There we are. Vayar Yisrael es b'nei Yosef vayomer mi eleh. Yaakov saw the sons of Yosef and he said, "Who are these?" Says Rashi, "Bikesh levorchom." He wanted to give them a bracha, and he stalko shchino mimenu, and the shchino removed itself from him. Why? Lefishi osi Yerovam ve'achav lotzes me'Ephraim ve'Yehu levonav v'Menashe. Because Yerovam would come, Achav would come from Ephraim, and Yehu would come from Menashe. Vayomer mi eleh, and he says, "Who are these? Meheichon yotsu eleh she'enam ruyim libracha? Where do these children come from that they're unfit for a bracha?" So there we have a case of Yaakov wanting to give a bracha and feeling the Shechina is no longer with him, and he can't give that bracha. Why? Because in years to come, a few rishoyim are going to result from this, are going to be born out of this particular person, and he is not prepared to give him a bracha. The Ribbono Shel Olam removes himself from them. And the case of Esau. Look at the Rishoyim, look at all the wicked people that have come out of Esau. And Esau himself was so wicked. What chance is there that as Yitzchok would have been about to bestow the brachas on Esau, that God would not have removed these presents from him? Of course he would. There's no way Esau would have got the brachas. Particularly in the light of the fact that Esau had forgone his rights. There was a deal between Esau and Yaakov. Esau had given that right to the bracha over to Yaakov. So there was no chance that the bracha was going to land up in Esau's hands. If that's the case, why does God organize it such that we need this whole charade? Esau coming in tired and hungry, Yaakov being preparing the food, the deal that goes, the selling of the birthright, and then Esau being sent out to bring some food for Yitzchok, Rivka overhearing it, the whole story as it develops. What for? Yaakov dressing himself up as Esau, fooling his father. Why was it necessary to introduce such intrigue into this stage of the development of the Jewish people when it all could have been done quite simply? All that you needed to happen was Esau would have come for his bracha, Yitzchak would have put his hands on Esau's head and would have said, my goodness, what, I can't give you a bracha. Look at all the Rishoyim that are coming out of you. The Shechina is gone. And he would have given the bracha to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, and that would have been the end of the story. So somehow this intrigue seems to be an inherent necessity in the development of the theme. And I spoke about it many years ago. And we'll take a similar line with slight variations this evening. Rivka is very worried during the period of her pregnancy. There was tremendous movement inside her and conflict, and she finds this very difficult to handle. And she goes to seek Hashem. Literally, that's what it means, to seek Hashem. Says Rashi, Vayisroitzatzu, what does it mean? When she used to walk past the Beis HaMedrash, when she used to walk past the shul, or the place of learning of Shem Ve'Ever, Yaakov rots and Mepathis lotzes. Yaakov made efforts to come out. He got excited. He started getting all wanting to get out. When she passed the place of idol worship, Esav Mepathis lotzes. Esav started kicking and trying to get out. And she was very concerned. What kind of a child is this? Doesn't he know where he stands? What is it? We walk past the Beis HaMedrash, he tries to get out. We walk past Avodah Zarah, he tries to get out. And she was concerned. She goes to seek Hashem, goes to Shem Ve'Eved to ask what's happening. And she's told, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, there are two nations inside of you. And two nations will separate from your womb immediately upon birth. These two children are going to go into different directions. So these are twins. Why does that satisfy her? Why does she feel better now? She was worried. What was she worried about? It wasn't the physical pain of the children's kicking that she was worried about, or the child's kicking that she was worried about. She was worried about the motivation for that kicking, but there seemed to be an attraction to two opposites. Once she's told she has two children, they're twins, and they are opposites, then she feels more comfortable. Then she understands what it is. This isn't a confused individual being pulled in opposite directions. These are two individuals. Two individuals she can cope with. And these two individuals are born with completely different qualities. Esav is born with physical perfection. He's born mature. He's born with hair. Not just with hair on his head, but with hair on all his body. Physical maturity is part of the physical world. A child is capable of all its physical functions, of almost all its physical functions, the moment it's born. It can function as a physical being. It is totally incapable of functioning mentally, intellectually, or spiritually. That comes later. The complete perfection with which Esav is born emphasizes the physical being that he was. Whereas Yaakov is born normally. Esav is born with this exterior coating, with this covering of fur, also representing the external perfections of Esav. Externally, Esav must have been a magnificent being. Not only physically magnificent, but as we see right through, he manages to fool his father by his external behavior. So his conduct externally was also impeccable. This was a human being who was entirely external. His physical externality was outstanding, and his spiritual externality was outstanding. He appeared from the outside to be perfect. And he used that ability that he had, which is the ability, its appearances. Appearances have become a very important science, a very important technique. Image building. It's a big industry today. What is image building? Image building is, it doesn't matter what I am, it's what's important is how I come across. And the image builders take all sorts of inadequate people and make them come across adequately. They can crack up when they get home. That's not the image builder's problems. That's the marriage counselor's problems. that while they're at work, the image builders teach them to function as if they really are something special. The image building is really a function of manipulation. It is an ability to influence the way one is perceived and the effect that will have on a negotiation, on a discussion, on whatever, which might or might not be true. But it's already a form of manipulation. Manipulation is from the outside outward. Manipulation has nothing to do with the inside. It's the ability of the human being to operate, to manipulate, and to function in the world around him, which is totally independent of his own value system. And that was Esav. Esav was the manipulator par excellence. He was able to manipulate his father. He was able to manipulate women, as we're told. He tied the fiv. There was, it says that Yaakov loved, Yitzchak loved Esav, ki tied the fiv. What does that mean? Because there was game in his mouth. What does it mean that Yaakov was, that Yitzchak was completely taken in by the food? Certainly not, explains Rashi. Yodea Tzayid, what does it mean? Lotzud ulerama yisis obiv befiv. He knew how to hunt and how to cheat his father with his mouth. Vashoya aloi abo hech maasu nisamelach vesateven. He used to ask his father all sorts of chumras. How do you take maaser from salt? How do you take maaser from straw? And his father would think, goodness, he's so careful, he's so medakdek. Those are just examples of how he would manipulate his father's mind, and so he could manipulate the minds of others as well. His father loving him because there was Sayyid Befiv, says Rashi, Ketalguma Befiv Shel Yitzchok. The simple translation means he loved Esav because Esav brought him delicious things to eat. Esav excelled in the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, he honored his father. Umedrosho Befiv Shel Esav. But the medrash is Ketayid Befiv because there was the art of hunting in the mouth of Esav. He was able to use his mouth to hunt with. What does hunting mean? What are you doing? You're outwitting the animal. That's the thrill of hunting. Hunting is not just a matter of killing. If a person wanted to kill animals, it would become a shochet. That's not what thrill is. You can't take a hunter and say, look, give up your hunting. We're short of shochetim. Go to the abattoirs and they'll bring you as many animals as you want, and you can shecht them. And he'll say, no, with a knife, that's not the way he likes to use a gun. He'll say, you know what, you can shef for the goyim as well. They'll be any to please if we give them the day off. You want to shoot, you'll shef with a knife for the yidden, you'll shef with a gun for the goyim. You can use a bow and arrow if you want to, anything you want. He won't hear that. Nothing. Why not? Because he's not pitting his skills of deception against the animal. The art of hunting is not just the art of catching the animal, it's mastering the animal through overpowering it with the man's own hunting skills. And it always used to worry me and intrigue me. What does a man get out of hunting in the sense of, say, the chokhmah? So you manage to outwit an animal. Outwit a human being, I can understand. But to outwit an animal? But you're outwitting the animal, and if it's real hunting, you're outwitting the animal with intuition. You're working with the animal's kelim, not with your own. It doesn't help taking machine guns and night vision equipment and all sorts of things. That's no chokhmah. But if one goes out into the jungle and one uses trackers to smell and to watch the spur, you're using very physical forms of tracking the animal and outwitting the animal. There I can already understand that you're pitting your skills, your animal skills, against the animal's animal skills. That tzayid is manipulation, is to find the weakness of the animal and to overpower the animal by dominating it in its area of weakness. And that's that Yitzchak loved Esav ki tzayid befiv, the medrash is, for he had the art of hunting people with his mouth. He had the art of oratory, he had the art of smooth talk. He was a salesman par excellence, but well, perhaps in a sense that's what he is. And we have to analyze where that fits in exactly. He could get people to do whatever he wanted them to do using his mouth. Isn't that a salesman? Or a politician, whatever you want to call him. That was his kerch. So why was Yitzchak attracted to that power? Yitzchak wasn't a fool. Yitzchak wasn't naive. Why is Yitzchak attracted to that power of manipulation? Yitzchak has to go through the question of analyzing why this has happened to him. Why has he been given these two children? Why are they twins? And why does one sit like a tzaddik and learn, and the other excels in the power of manipulation? And Yitzchok comes to the conclusion that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants these two powers separated. The power of emes, the power of truth, which Yitzchok must have been able to see from the very beginning, was the forte of Yaakov, his total commitment to uncompromising truth. That does not go hand in hand with manipulation. And yet, if we don't know how to manipulate, and manipulate doesn't necessarily have a negative connotation. Manipulate comes from manus, the hand. It's to handle, to operate. The power of operating in the world, the power of motivating, the power of manipulation from its positive meaning all the way through, cannot be practiced by somebody who's committed to the absolute truth. And Yaakov sees an opportunity. Yitzchok sees an opportunity here. I have two sons. One a manipulator and one is emes. And if these two sons can remain linked together as they were in the womb, then we can produce a most powerful team. Then we have the politicians and the salesmen on the one hand, the public relations people, and we have the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rabbonim and the Talmidei Chachomim on the other hand, and they work hand in hand. That will guarantee the purity of the emes. Now, there's always a problem with public relations, and that is, it is so close to sheker. It is so close to crossing the border of honesty. When you start marketing, and when marketing becomes an end in itself, and sometimes it comes to a point even where you're marketing nothing, and the marketing is entirely an end in itself, or what you're marketing is very small, or what you're marketing is sometimes negative. And one has to be very careful that public relations, as important as it is as a form of communication, doesn't compromise the truth, doesn't compromise the purity of what one's trying to market. Yitzchok sees the opportunity of developing Esav into the marketer of Torah, the international marketer of Torah. He's the person who can deal with the world far more effectively than Yaakov can deal with the world. For Yaakov to deal with the world is a come down. For Yaakov to have to deal with the world is a distraction, it's a disturbance, and there is the risk of it compromising the purity of his emes, the purity of his truth. But if Esav, functioning hand in hand with Yaakov, will deal with the world, he's a far more effective manipulator. He'll be able to deal with the world and to come out on top. And in fact, we see from the brocha which Yitzchok would have given to Esav, what did he plan to say to Esav? You'll have wealth. Ya'avducho amim, nations will serve you. V'yishtachavu l'cho l'umim, and peoples will bow down to you. Heveigevil le'achecho, you'll be powerful to your brothers. V'yishtachavu l'cho b'nei emecho, and the sons of your mother will bow to you. Those who curse you will be cursed, and those who bless you will be blessed. He's giving him power, enormous power, wealth, and the power to enslave all of humanity. That's what he plans to give to Esav. He sees Esav as the one who can carry off that power. Esav who can give it effect, and Esav who through that power can promote the interests of the Torah to the wider world. And Yitzchok sees this as an incredible opportunity. Rivka, of course, knows it isn't going to be. Rivka knows that Esav used to try and get out to Avodah Zorah right at the beginning, to the places of idolatry. She knew from Shem and Eva that these nations that were going to develop, Yaakov and Esav, were going to be going in opposite directions. They weren't going to work together. This wasn't one team. These were opposing teams, and they would be opposing teams for all of eternity. That Yitzchok didn't know. Or Yitzchok certainly knew that Esav was not the greatest tzaddik. In fact, how did he think Esav was going to promote the interests of Torah if he knew that Esav was a degenerate human being? How did he think he was going to promote the interests of Torah? The Shem Mishmuel says, and he bases it on an interesting halacha in Chulin, in Daf Nun Ches, that if an animal becomes treif, Treif means that an animal develops a certain disease. And there are a number of treifas of different types of diseases, all recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. The common denominator among all those diseases are that they will terminate the animal's life within a period of 12 months. And if an animal has one of those diseases, the animal is called treif. Talking about a kosher animal, an animal, a cow, an ox, a sheep, develops one of these diseases, the animal is treif. What if the animal is pregnant? So there's a fetus inside the animal. The fetus doesn't have the disease. Is the fetus kosher or is the fetus not kosher? So the halacha is, in other words, we check the animal properly. So everything's fine, everything's okay. We open the animal up and we find that the animal, the mother, has a lung disease, but the child, the fetus is perfect. What is the status of the fetus? So the halacha is, it depends when the pregnancy took place in relation to the disease. If the animal had the disease and then became pregnant, then the fetus is kosher. If the animal became pregnant and then developed the disease, the fetus is treif. Says the Shem Bishmur, the philosophic principle here, not just the halachic principle, but the philosophic principle is that the fetus is affected by the change. But if the change takes place before the fetus is developed, then the fetus is not affected by the existence of the disease. What impacts on us is change, not what exists. That's a very interesting concept altogether. For example, if you're traveling in a train that's traveling at a constant speed of 80 kilometers an hour, you don't feel the movement if it's a good train. If you're traveling at 10 kilometers an hour and the train increases its speed from 10 kilometers an hour to 60 kilometers an hour, you feel it good and proper. What are you feeling? You're feeling the acceleration. The status is unimportant. Status doesn't affect us. Change affects us. We are moved by change. We're not moved by status. And that's why we get used to things. We enjoy changes in standard of living. The person was earning 4,000 rand a month and he gets an increase to 5,000 rand a month. That's wonderful. How long is it wonderful for? The first month. The second month it's back to normal. It's as if nothing's happened. He doesn't feel that pleasure anymore. He enjoys the change. He doesn't enjoy the new status. The change, and that's why we pursue change so much. That's part of our uneasiness. That's part of our unsettled state of being. We enjoy the change. We enjoy the feeling of progress. And that's why we're so concerned about the emotional state of a Yerid Min HaChosef, somebody who loses his money. A person who's always been poor, who's only got a few hundred rand in the bank and nothing to eat, is a poor person. We have to help him. But a millionaire or a billionaire who's lost 10 million rand, he's still got half a million. We treat him very, very subtly and very, very carefully. Because the feeling of loss, it doesn't matter where you were and where you came. What's important is how far the drop is. Not important where you are. The fact is that he's still got half a million rand, and whereas this man's got nothing, he hasn't got a penny. Doesn't matter, this man hasn't fallen. It's the fall which damages, and it's the climb which stimulates. It's not where you're holding, it's the movement, it's the acceleration, it's the velocity that really develops and affects people. And so it's not a question of the animal has a disease, does it affect the Uber? Does it affect the fetus? What's important is the animal has developed the disease. The development of the disease will affect the fetus if the fetus is there when the development takes place. If the fetus is not there when the development takes place, the existence of the disease is irrelevant. That's the Shem Yishmuel's concept. And he says Yitzchok had the view that Esav was the best placed person to bring the whole world to Torah. Because Esav was wicked. And they would accept him and they would become part of him and he would become part of them. And then he would do tshuva. He would change. And with that change, they would be affected too. They won't be affected by somebody who's on a high level. But if they are related, if they are involved with Esav at the time that he undergoes the change, then they'll come along with him. Which is an interesting concept. Of course, one has to watch it both ways. That means that a tzaddik, for example, who changes for the worst, chas v'sholom, if a righteous person, a fine person, degenerates and deteriorates, that affects the society. If an ordinary person improves himself and raises himself, that affects the society. We're affected by changes. We're not affected by status. We get very used to things. We begin to take things very for granted. And we adjust to them and we adapt to them and we no longer notice them. We only notice when something has changed. And how a person can walk into this room 3 times a day, and after 10 years of doing that, you can say to them, what color are the curtains? As their kittens didn't even notice, or blinds didn't have notice, or their blinds didn't notice. If you take the blinds away, all of a sudden he looks and says, what's changed here? What's gone? He's noticed the change, he's adapted, he's responded to the change. It's like that with people. Sometimes we don't notice that people exist until never they've gone. And all of a sudden it strikes us what we've lost. It shouldn't be that way. We should be able to find pleasure in existence, not just pleasure in change. But that's how it is. And so says the Shem Yishmuel, Yitzchok's idea was that Esau, through becoming involved with the broader society, through becoming involved with the non-Jewish world, would ultimately do tshuva as a result of these brachas, as a result of these blessings. And that change in status in Esau, taking this ordinary man who was a good friend of the goyim and elevating him now, him elevating himself, would bring with him all the other nations of the world as well, and that would bring to finality the ultimate goal of the world, that there should be one Memsholo, there should be one ruler, there should be one Ribbono Shel Olam, accepted by all of society and governing all of society. That was the picture. And that could then be achieved, in Yitzchok's mind, without in any way compromising Yaakov. Yaakov would remain pure, Yaakov would remain unaffected, Yaakov would remain non-political, Yaakov would not become involved in public relations. From Yaakov you would always be able to get an honest answer. When you go to a marketing person, not so easy to get an honest answer. Not so easy. Because his mind works in a different way already. His mind works. Somebody told me, I know an honest marketer. And she went to England, she went to London, and opened an office in London. And she's failing there. And I said, why are you failing in London? She's losing a lot of money there. She said, it's amazing what goes on there. She says, and I sit down and I talk to somebody, I say to them at the beginning of the conversation, let's not waste time, let's be open, I'll tell you exactly what I want to do, I'll tell you exactly what I want out of it, and why I'm doing it, I'll tell you exactly what it's going to cost you, and let's work from there. And she says, that's how I always work with my clients. I need to know exactly what I want out of it, why I'm doing it, what's motivating me, and what I expect from it. And then we can negotiate and deal. She says, with the Englishmen, when I've done that, they assume that I'm lying. They know that that can't be the truth. Their thing is just to figure out in their minds what I really mean. And she said, I just can't deal with it. So she said, I went to the chairman of my organization, and I appointed a member of parliament to be the chairman of my organization. And I think he's a Sir, in fact. And I said to him, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why I can't manage it. And I told him the story. And he said, she told me, aren't you aware of the fact of the complete absence of any kind of integrity in the city of London over the last 10 years? Which is interesting, because that in our minds is one of the last citadels of honest dealing. Bank of England, City of London, true, that's the place where there's integrity. There isn't. Not anymore. Marketing has gone off on a tangent of its own, and is not governed by any ethical system, and not governed by any legal system in a sense, any internal legal system. And so it's very difficult. Once you're involved in marketing, it becomes very, very difficult. There's an expectation that you're not telling the truth, and once there's an expectation that you're not telling the truth, it's very difficult to stick to it. It's very difficult to disappoint people. And so Yitzchok felt secure that by leaving Yaakov totally out of the field of marketing, totally out of the field of politics, totally out of the field of business, Yaakov could remain absolutely pure. But the Ribbono Shel Olam's plan is different, and Rivka is part of that plan. And through marketing, and through public relations, and through manipulation, Yaakov has to recover the rights to those brachos. It's true they're inherently his. It's true that there is no way that Esav is going to get those brachas. So there's no question of theft, chas v'shalom. Yaakov is not taking anything at all that he wouldn't be getting inevitably. But the method of getting it that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants is that Yaakov himself has to learn the art of manipulation. Yaakov has to learn how to manipulate the arch manipulator. Esav, the master of all manipulators, the Rebbe of all future politicians, the teacher of all marketers, the businessman of businessmen, the manipulator of manipulators, has to be outwitted by the yeshiva bochur. Then Torah can function. And the Ribbono Shel'Olam organizes things in such a way that has to happen. That's the way it has to work. That the appearance has to be the natural way, the natural development has to be one of Yaakov developing something of that power which Esav has. And in fact, dominating Esav in his area of expertise. Not only dominating him with chokhmah, not only dominating him with wisdom and with intellect, but even dominating him in his own area, in that field of marketing. I'll tell you when it pops up. What did Yaakov think? What did Yitzchok think when Yaakov appears before him? He comes and gives the food to his father. Vayovo el Ovi, Vayomer Ovi, this is my father. Vayomer hineni miato bini. He says, yes, who are you? What does he mean, who are you? You can hear that it's his son, it's either Yaakov or Esau. Who are you? So immediately Yaakov opens his mouth. Yitzchok is in doubt. Who are you? Vayomer Yaakov el Elo Ovi, when Yaakov says to his father, Anochi Esav b'chirecho, I am Esav, your firstborn. Osisi kasher dibarto eloi, I've done as you've spoken to me. Kumno, please sit up. Shvo v'ochlo mitzedi, sit up and eat from my game. Ba'avu tevorachani nafshecho, so that your soul will bless me. Vayomer Yitzchok el benoi, ma'azeh mihato limtzoi b'ni. How come so fast? It's very quick to get back from the field. So now not only doesn't he sound like Esav, he's not speaking like Esav, and he's come with such speed that it can't be Esav. Hashem, your God, came before me. I had siyata d'shmaya. Let me feel you. So what is he thinking? I'll feel him and it'll be clear that it's Yaakov. So it's clear in Yitzchok's mind at this point that somebody's trying to pull the wool over his eyes. It's clear that he's being fooled. Let me feel you, ha'atozeh b'ni Esav imloi, if you are Esav or not. Let me touch you. So what is he expecting to find? He's expecting to find, it's not Esav, so who will it be then? Yaakov. So he knows that it's Yaakov. Vayigash Yaakov el Yitzchok Oviv, vayimusheyu, and Yaakov comes, draws close to his father. You can imagine how Yaakov's heart is beating at this point. His father is about to find out. And he feels him. Vayomer, what does his father say now? Now he's in trouble. He feels like Esav. Hakol kol Yaakov v'hayodayim yidei Esav, he says. The voice is the voice of Yaakov, and the hands are the hands of Esav. No, sir. So what's the answer? Is it Yaakov or is it Esav? Can't be both. He didn't recognize him. Ki hayu yodav kidei Esav ochiv, because his hands were like the hands of Esav, his brother. Siro is hairy. And he blessed him. And then again he says, Vayomer atozeh b'ni Esav, are you Esav? Vayomer ani, and he says, yes, I am, he says. Vayomer agisholi v'ichlo mitzeh b'ni, give me the food and make me fit. What does he think? He hasn't resolved it yet. The only conclusion he's come to is that the call, the voice is the voice of Yaakov and the hands are the hands of Esav. But that's not possible. So how can you give the brocha without resolving it? Why not call Rivka in? Why not call your wife in and just say, tell me, darling, who's this man standing in front of me? I'm blind. I can't see. That's all. He doesn't make that effort. He's willing to go ahead. And I must tell you that I spoke about this well over 10 years ago. And since then, I've been searching for a source for what I'm saying, and I haven't been able to find it. But what I'm suggesting is that Yitzchok's conclusion is, it doesn't make any difference which son it is. I don't care who it is. If the voice is the voice of Yaakov and the hands are the hands of Esav, then this is neither Yaakov nor Esav. This is a new son. This is a son who has been able to merge the marketing abilities, the manipulative abilities of Esav with the inherent qualities of Yaakov, all in one man. I thought it had to be two, says Yitzchok. And here I see a person who's been able to retain his internal integrity. He speaks nicely, he speaks refinedly, as Chazal point out. He says, please, he says, thank you, not like Esav. So that he has that internal emiskite, he's been able to retain that internal truth and that internal refinement. and yet he's been able to develop the art of deception. Because Mimonoshach, either way, what's happened? Either this is Esau who's learned how to become a mensch, or this is Yaakov who's learned how to manipulate. And either of them are okay. It doesn't matter. That means I now have a son who's combined the qualities of both, which I thought was impossible. And whichever one it is is good. So he doesn't have to find out if it's Yaakov or if it's Esau. This is in fact the person who's Akol Kol Yaakov Ayodai Midei Esau. That's the conclusion he reaches. This is a man whose internal qualities are the qualities of a Yaakov, and his external qualities are the qualities of an Esau. This is an ideal person. And he's a person for whom the brachas are fit. And so he has the food and he gives him the brachas. And the brachas are the brachas of power. Because such a person can handle the wealth, such a person can handle the power. And we find that the brachas then, both the spiritual succession of Yitzchok and the physical succession of Yitzchok, the material succession of Yitzchok, goes into the hands of Yaakov. This development is very important, and it's partially has a contemporary effect of which I spoke about this morning in the Radishir. And that is the understanding that at the end of the day, in an imperfect world, marketing is a necessity. And manipulation is a necessity. Some form of manipulation is a necessity. In a perfect world, if the world were a world of emes, it wouldn't be necessary. In a world of emes, you wouldn't need to market, you would merely need to inform the public. So if you had a product, you could simply put a notice in the paper that such and such a product is available, these are its features, and this is how much it costs, and this is where it's available. And anyone who wanted it would come and buy it. But it isn't like that. We're living in an imperfect world, and even good things need to be promoted. People are not automatically attracted to that which is good. They need to be motivated. And of course that puts into the hands of marketers the possibility of abuse as well. Once one learns how to motivate people to want things, you can motivate them to want things which aren't good for them too. That is the negative power of marketing. But in a world which is imperfect, we find the need for marketing, one finds the need for manipulation. According to the Sipurimu, that's in fact what happened as a result of eating from the tree of knowledge, where that which is good and that which is pleasant became confused. Until that time, until Adam ate from the tree of knowledge, there was a clear distinction. Good things were pleasant and bad things were unpleasant. From the time of the eating of the tree of knowledge, goodness and pleasantness were two different concepts. A thing could be good and not delicious, and a thing could be delicious and bad. And that causes all the confusion. That's why we need marketing. Because we have to take something which is good, even if it isn't delicious, and we've got to make people want it. If it's delicious, they want it in any case. That's easy, but that doesn't mean it's good. Marketing is to take something which we believe is good and to create the desire for that thing in people. And therein lies the negatives of marketing. And in marketing, we're talking about marketing in the broadest sense, communication. The ability to project to other people, the ability to again manipulate, and again I'm using the term manipulate not negatively, let's say to influence people, to communicate with people in that sense, to be able to modify people's attitudes, to be able to modify people's desires, to be able to modify people's ambitions. That's the art of communication, that's the art of manipulation, of marketing. It's interesting, I was talking to a group of non-Jewish businessmen, after which they told me they had a problem with a manager, a very large quasi-government organization. What happened with the manager is he was promoted from job to job, and so finally he had a senior management position, and he just stopped functioning. And he'd been to all their personnel people, and he'd been to psychologists, and nothing had worked. So they brought him to me while I was there, and in 2 minutes I said, what is the problem? He said, well, it's an ethical problem. My job now entails manipulation and I'm not willing to manipulate people. Simple as that. So I sat down with him and in 10 minutes explained to him what manipulation is, and that the word manipulation has such a negative connotation, but it doesn't need to be negative. Of course there is a negative part to it. Of course, taken to an extreme, it becomes negative and distraction. But one can manipulate people to do good. One can manipulate people to become better. That's called motivation. We just give it different terms and then it becomes kosher. What it is to advertise, to market, that's okay. To manipulate is bad. That's correct. There is a point at which it's good and there's a point at which it's bad, but it doesn't depend on the word you use. It depends on what you're manipulating people to do. If one is manipulating people to do things which are in their interest and which are good for them, that's called positive, that's called education, it's called motivation, it's called whatever you want to call it. If you're manipulating people to do what's good for you, even though it's not good for them, that's of course negative manipulation. And once he understood the definitions, he was able to function. And they told me a few weeks later he was back to normal, perfect manager, doing very well indeed. There can be a tremendous confusion in the role of manipulation. Manipulation means being able to operate in the world, being able to project, being able to communicate, being able to affect people, being able to change people. That's the art of manipulation. There is a tendency today to view the role that a person can play in the Torah world in a very unidimensional way, where a person is led to believe that the only way he can be contributive in the Torah world is, or only one of two ways he can be contributive, is either to be a Talmid Chacham himself or to be a contributor, a financial contributor to Torah. And that's it. So you either go to yeshiva for years and years and become a Talmid Chacham, or you can become a businessman or whatever and give money to yeshivas, and that's also good. That's fine. Those are two ways of contributing. But they're not the only ways, and they're not necessarily the most satisfactory of ways. It's important to realize also that there are people whose talents don't lie in those areas. There are people whose talents lie in other areas. And when we're talking about making a contribution, we're talking about making a contribution with one's talents, not just with one's assets. So if a person has the ability to become a Talmid Chacham, he has that talent, he has that tendency, he has that character, then of course the best thing he can possibly do is to spend every minute he can developing himself in his learning and in his teaching abilities so that he can become a great Talmid Chacham. What happens if he isn't that kind of person? He isn't the world's biggest intellect. He isn't able to sit for hours and hours with a sefer in front of him. That's not him. What do we do with him then? So we say to him, look, well, sorry, you're not going to make it. We do one of two things. We either say to him, sit, learn, keep on learning. And eventually what happens? He fails. And he gets more and more frustrated, and he doesn't make it. And then one of two things happens. He just carries on learning in a most mediocre fashion, or he eventually drops out of learning and tries to make it in something else. But by that time he's already well on in years, he's got responsibilities at home, and he never really makes it in other fields either, so he becomes a person who's never made it. That's one thing that can happen. The second thing that can happen is that we say to him, look, you're not going to make it in Torah, so you become a second-class citizen, become a barabos, and you'll make some money and you'll give your money to Torah, that's also nice. Which it is, it's also nice. But it doesn't make him feel unique. It doesn't make him feel that he's using his abilities, that he's using his talents and his skills for Torah. There is a third possibility, which used to always be emphasized. And that is the role of the professional balabos, the role of the layman within Torah society. The role of the layman not only as a financial supporter, the role of the layman as an organizational supporter, as the operator, as the public relations man, as the manipulator where that has to be done. There's a whole area. If Torah is going to function in the modern world, there's a whole area that needs to be developed. There's a whole area in which there needs to be excellence quite apart from the area of the learning of Torah. And in all communities there used to be groups of outstanding balabatim. An outstanding balabos is a person who had enormous appreciation of Torah. A person who was committed to Torah, who raised his children in Torah. A person who spent several hours a day learning. But that wasn't his unique contribution to Torah. He realized that in his learning there were people who could learn better than him. That isn't where he was going to make it. His contribution in Torah was to use his organizational skills, or to use his communication skills, or to use his public relations skills, to use his contacts, whatever it might have been, to promote the interests of Torah. Yitzchok, as we've seen, understood these two roles, and made no effort to lead Esav into the role of Talmid Chacham. That's something we have to appreciate too. He realized what Esav's skills were. And his intention was that Esav should become an outstanding balabos, he should become a great political leader, he should become a great financial leader, and he should use that power for Torah. He didn't send him to yeshiva. He didn't say sit with the Sefer and carry on learning, maybe after all something will come of you. He took the powers and the potential of Esav and tried to develop it within the area of Esav's greatness. What the Ribbono Shel Olam designs here is, yes, that's fine, but within the Jewish people. It gets excited when people stop listening, they fall asleep. Exactly the opposite of people. The Ribbono Shel Olam teaches us and unravels the story in such a way that the ability to organize that whole operational area is incorporated within the Jewish people. And at what level of Jewish people? At the level of Yaakov. That's the level. Within the Frum people, within the Torah people. Within that area it has to be. This idea of total separation, that there should be one nation that excels in MS, so to say, and another that excels in operations, that's not what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't see a stero, he doesn't see a contradiction between operations and between MS. Provided MS dominates, provided operations are being led and directed by truth, and not truth being led and directed by operations. That's what is so critically important in the role of public relations when it comes to an area such as Torah. That you don't do things because it looks good in terms of image. You do that which is right, and you can incorporate public relations to promote that which you're doing. But you're doing that which is right, and that's the way that it functions. And now inside of the camp of Yaakov, we have these two powers. Still very often separated into two human beings. That has remained of Yitzchok's scheme. That you will have the people who dedicate themselves to the purity of Torah, and you'll have the people who operate, you'll have the people who manipulate. But it's within the Torah camp, it's all within Yiddishkeit, it's all within the Torah, it's not two different camps in which this develops. This desire of Yitzchok is expressed in the Medrash when he sends Esav out to find the game. And he uses particular terminology which the Medrash interprets. So no chelyecho, telyecho v'kashtecho. Take all your hunting equipment. Says the Medrash, telyecho? What does it mean? Telyecho zu madai. That's the kingdom of Persia. Kashtecho your bow zu yovon. And the Medrash brings psukim to support us. That's Greece. Say hasode zu edom. Go to the field, that's edom. So when he says to Yaakov, so no chelyecho, telyecho v'kashtecho. But say hasode, lift up your implements. What are those implements? What are your implements, Esav? What is going to be the tools with which you're going to make a contribution to Torah? Says the Medrash, that's Yovan, that's Greece, that's Madai, the Persia, that's Edom. These are the great kingdoms, the great non-Jewish kingdoms. You're going to get involved there, and you're going to bring them back under the rule of the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately. And it's in that area that Yaakov has to say, so to say, outwit Esav, and master that art to such an extent that he can negotiate for himself. What's interesting is that of all the others, it's Yaakov who's known for emes. Avraham was known for chesed, that was his outstanding leader, kindness. Yitzchak is known for gevura, uncompromising strength, that was the power of Yitzchak. Yaakov, what is Yaakov known for? Emes. How does the story of Yaakov start? Doing Esav out of his bechira, so to say. Then telling lies to his father, so to say, about whether he's Esav or he isn't. Later on we have the story of Lavan, where he outwits Lavan. Who is constantly outwitting the biggest crooks in the world? Yaakov, the Ish Emes, the man of truth. The Torah's concept of truth is not naivety. Truth doesn't mean the inability to operate. Truth doesn't mean the ability to protect oneself from the distortions of an inadequate world, from the distortions of a distorted world. And that's also something that we have to be careful, is not to lead one to believe that truth can only be developed through isolation. That one cannot operate in the world and be true at the same time. That's not true either. That's not correct either. We see that middle of Emes is in Yaakov. And he gets that middle when he learns how to operate with it. And he learns how to function with it. Emes does not just mean theoretical truth. Emes means a great deal more than theoretical truth. Emes is making the truth work. Emes is manipulating the world to achieve the ends of truth too. It's not good enough to have truth in an ivory tower. It's not good enough to have an institution that stands for truth but has no effect on its environment. At the end of the day, truth is expressed by the way people operate with one another. Truth is expressed by the changes we bring about. And sometimes there has to be, I was going to say compromise, but that's not the correct word. Sometimes there has to be adaptation in order to achieve the ends of truth in an untrue world. And that adaptation is part of the truth that has to be affected. You remember the beautiful Medrash in the beginning of Bereishis, where the different Midas are debating whether man should be created or not. Nasu amalochei shores kisim kisim. The angels formed themselves into different schools, into different groups. Mehem aimrim al yiboro, mehem aimrim yiboro. Some said man should be created, some said man shouldn't be created. Which were the ones that said he should? Chesed aimer yiboro, shugomer chasodim. Chesed, the social qualities, said, sure, you must make man. People will be good to one another. Chesed, man is the ideal expression of social values. The emes aimer al yiboro. And emes says, don't create man, because shekulish koro, man is deceitful. Tzedek omer yiboro, righteousness is creating. Shulay says tzedokas, he'll do charity. Shalom omer al yiboro, Shalom says, peace says, you can't create man. The kulik toto, man is inherently argumentative, there won't be peace. Me'os HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what does he do? Notal emes v'yishlicho el oritz. He takes emes and throws it out to the earth. Omer maloch ha'shoes v'kna HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ribonu yolo ma'atam b'vazet tzatzis al tichzi yashulcho. Emes is the one you threw out, the most precious of all you threw out. How could you do that? Says the Ribbono Shel'olam, Tale Emes Min Ha'oretz. Let truth come up from the earth. What does that mean, let truth come up from the earth? Says the Ribbono Shel'olam, I don't want to be dealing with absolute truth that doesn't work. I want to be dealing with man's ability to take truth and to model it in a way that does work. To make truth practical. That's what I want in the world. That's what I'm creating the world for. To be able to take truth and not, chas v'sholem, to compromise it. That word is incorrect, because a compromise of truth is no longer true. But to take truth and adapt it. How do you do that? What is the difference between taking truth and compromising it and taking truth and adapting it? Because you have to do one of the two. You cannot take ideal truth, you cannot take absolute truth and operate in an imperfect world and still maintain it as it is. There has to be adaptation at least, or compromise. You're going to need Hayadayim Yedei Esav. You're going to need hands of Esav to manipulate. What's important is the call still the call of Yaakov? Has the voice changed? Has the way of speaking changed? Has the message changed? One has to be able to manipulate with one's hands, leaving the message, the internal, has to remain uncorrupted. That's adaptation. Compromise is when, in order to make it easier to manipulate, you change the message too. Examples of that are very simple. Taking one of the clearest examples. When a group of Jews decide that since nowadays most people drive to shul on Shabbos, so instead of making them feel bad, let's change the law. Let's say there's nothing wrong with driving to shul on Shabbos. That's called compromising the truth to make it work. And they'll argue and they'll say, but isn't it better that way? So people come to shul, they feel good in themselves, they feel happy, they don't feel guilty, they feel part of the Jewish community, they don't feel they're outside of it. Good argument. What's wrong with the argument? You're dying your day, so you've been manipulated, you're trying to make it work. The problem is, I call Yaakov, there's no voice of Yaakov in you. There's no integrity in the internal, the message you're saying has changed. You can't change the message. You can change the application. You can change the way it functions, but you can't change the message. As you might have another viewpoint that says people are driving to shul, let's turn a blind eye. It's not right to turn a blind eye. If we were dealing with absolute MS, we should have policemen outside the shul chasing away anybody who drives up to the shul. What kind of business is this? As we said last week, a passionate involvement with the MS, with the absolute truth, would require that we turn everybody away. You don't come to shul by car, off with you. That's what absolute truth should be. But we don't. We pretend we didn't see. What is that? Is that compromise? No, the message remains the same. It remains wrong to drive to shul. I'm not looking. Why am I not looking? Because that way at least these people will be coming to shul. That's an adaptation, but not a compromise. That's the kol Yaakov, that is retaining the voice of orthodoxy, despite the fact that one is compromising, so to say, or adapting the way it's being applied to allow a tolerance of an imperfect situation, just in order to preserve something at least. And it's important to appreciate that that Tale Emes Min Ha'oretz is a mission of the Jewish people that has to be shared by the Talmidei Chachomim and by the lay. The Talmidei Chachomim can work the Emes out. They operate with the Emes. But it's the lay people that adapt it. It's the lay people that make it work. It's the lay people that make it function. And one has to realize that that's not a second-class citizenship. That very often that role of the organizational mind, that role of the person who has the Yedei Esav, who has the ability to market, who has the ability to present, the ability to represent, the ability to communicate, that is used as a very prime and a very basic tool in the development of the world towards the time that the Ribbono Shel Olam is moving towards of his own leadership, where there will be one king and one kingdom. And that's the approach that I've taken with the parasha, an approach that sees the development of the new Yaakov as a new being, so to say, one that makes it irrelevant whether in fact he was Yaakov or whether he was Esav. What's important is a reversal of policy, whereas the policy initially was the Jewish people would be involved in pure emes, the non-Jewish world would be involved in manipulation, and somehow there would be a linkage between them. Yitzchok himself turns around to the school of thinking of Rivka, and the way that Ribbono Shel Olam originally operated, wanted it, that Esav can have no part in it. That deception which is based on deception, that deception that doesn't recognize emes, public relations that is willing to distort the truth for its own ends, can have no place and can have no role in the Torah world. But that doesn't mean that public relations and marketing can have no role. It's within the Torah world itself, it's within the world of Yaakov. He who was the Ish Tam Yeshev Ohalim, he was the man who sat in the Beis HaMedrash and learned. He has to develop the power and the ability to apply that Torah, to make it work, even in an inadequate environment. And lastly, it's important to appreciate, how do you set about that? Do you send people to business school to learn the arts of manipulation and then to yeshiva to learn emes? Or do you do it the other way around? We need to realize that if you start off with business school, you're finished. If you start off with marketing, you'll never learn the emes. Marketing is always going to be first and foremost. And emes is always going to be cut and distorted and fashioned to fit the image. That's not the way to do it. Yaakov Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. Firstly, one has to go to yeshiva to learn. Firstly, one has to involve oneself in the purity of Torah. One has to learn exactly what the essence of Torah is, what the uncompromising standards of Torah are. Later on, it comes automatically when one then finds oneself in the pressure and the hurly-burly of the real world, the practical world, where the absolute truth doesn't always work, one will find the abilities to make the necessary adaptations. There's the beautiful Ikrim that I've quoted before, where he discusses the shape of the cells in a beehive. We remember that the cells in the beehive, he asks, why aren't they circular? Why are they hexagonal? He says, really, one finds the circle is the most frequent shape used in nature. Curve, the circle is the strongest. Why hexagonal? So he answers, to make more space. Because circles waste space. If you had the cells all circular, there would be wasted space between every cell. In that case, he asks, why not squares? That would be a much easier structure to make. They could just lay long vertical lines and long lateral lines, and much quicker the bees would be able to make their cells. Use squares, equally efficient in its usage of space, or even more efficient in its usage of space, and much quicker. Answers the Ikrin, when you have to deviate from the ideal, you have to deviate as little as possible. The ideal would have been a circle. A circle isn't practical. So you go to the next structure which is closest to a circle but becomes practical. When you have to compromise the essence, you make only as much compromise as is necessary. You adapt only as far as is necessary. If you adapt one step beyond that, that one isn't entitled to do. And we see that with Yaakov himself. Yaakov has to tell a lie to Yitzchak. That's part of the Nevuah, that's part of that whole prophecy. When Yitzchak says, who are you? He has to say, I am Esav. And yet Rashi shows that in his phrasing, he phrases it in such a way that he retains a degree of integrity. He says, Ani, it is I. Who are you? Ani, it is I. Esav is your Bechor. That's how Rashi phrases it. Who are you trying to fool? If that's what he really said, Yitzchak would have picked it up. So he didn't really say it. He phrased that in such a way that Yitzchak wouldn't pick it up. So why did he do it then? Are you telling a lie or aren't you telling a lie? In business ethics, there's a principle that they've developed that is, there's no way of doing an unethical thing ethically. And you know how it goes with slogans. Slogans, people just hear and they accept. They don't practice it, they still accept it. There's no way of doing an unethical thing ethically. And you can ask anybody, do you agree with that? Of course you agree with that. If it's an unethical thing, you can't do it ethically. It's not true. Very often one has to do an unethical thing. Either by choice or by force. You still try and do it as ethically as you possibly can. Yaakov has to tell a lie. But he tells a lie in such a way that he retains a consciousness of the effort to keep it as little dishonest as possible. To maintain some degree of integrity in it for his own good, not for his father. And he's allowed to tell this lie. Now, Pialochi, he's got to tell this lie. And it's not unethical, in fact. But still, the words that are coming out of his mouth are words which in their simple sense are not correct, are not true. Yaakov modifies the words only as much as they need to be modified. He says only as much as he needs to, and he retains as much of the original meaning as he can to maintain his own integrity, just as the bees make hexagons and not squares. And so in the Kol Yaakov HaYadayim Yidei Esav, if we're careful to see at all times that while the voice remains whole, while the voice remains pure, the hands do only as much as is needed to make the purity of that voice, to make the truth of that voice effective in the wider world, able to contribute in the wider world, while still remaining its attachedness and its integrity to the universe.